I assume you're clapping because you've heard where the restrooms and the coffee is located. As we begin what is a very full day, I want to express thanks on behalf of the Institute's Board of Directors and our staff for the corporate and foundation sponsors who have enabled us to make this day hospitable for you all, the American International Group, the Boeing Corporation, and the Hauser Foundation have all helped to make sure that the coffee and the lunch and the arrangements for this event are as they should be for something that is as serious and weighty as what we will be discussing today. And in putting together the events of the day, just about all of our Institute staff have been contributing to the organization during the doldrums of August. And from what I've seen thus far, things are going smoothly. I'd like to mention them all by name. Time doesn't allow it, but I do want to give special thanks to Dr. Paul Stairs, who had the pleasure of the housekeeping announcement a moment ago. He is our recently appointed Director of Research and Studies. He has played a critical lead role in conceptualizing and organizing this event. A year ago, our country suffered its third direct attack in three centuries. The 21st century thus began with a profound shock to our sense of security. And any of you who saw the CNN replay earlier this week of the collapse of the World Trade Center towers can only feel renewed anguish at the sight of the people in those burning buildings faced with a terrifying dilemma of whether to burn or jump. And those of us professionally concerned with matters of national security and foreign policy, I think it's fair to say all of us feel a special obligation to do what we can to see that Americans, indeed people of any nation, are not faced with such a rending, lethal choice. Now, like the attack on us of December 7, 1941, September 11, 2001, has provoked us to think about the fundamental changes in our defenses and the way we deal with the rest of the world. The process of recasting America's national security and foreign policies that began with our entry into World War II and carried us through the Cold War years took more than a decade to fully play out. And today we're early in the process, a similar process of making the needed adjustments for dealing with a world in which sectarian extremism in the Muslim world, which expressed itself in terrorist violence, a world of proliferating weapons of mass destruction, a world in which the dislocations of globalization are creating security challenges, as well as opportunities for social and economic development. All these issues and challenges now require us to adjust these fundamental policies and institutions. And our purpose here today, consistent with the Institute's charter from Congress, is to spark policy dialogue, debate, and brainstorming. Our objective is to look at the fundamental long-term issues raised by the challenges of global terrorism. And to that end, we're fortunate to have on our program today a number of our country's most senior and experienced national security and foreign policy officials, former officials, and you'll be meeting with them during the day, our lead speaker in a moment. Now, I think many of you know that the Institute's special commitment is to encourage the evolution of foreign and security policies that deal with international conflict by political means. Institute Board Chairman Chester Crocker and I suggest in an op-ed piece that will come out tomorrow in the Christian Science Monitor, there's a longer version in your folders, we suggest that military action can only be the initial short-term response to the challenges of 9/11. Our successful military operations in Afghanistan have bought us time to develop a comprehensive national strategy for the long and complex struggle we now face. Today's conference presentations and the panel discussions will only touch on the most immediate of our current challenges. Issues explored today will be sustained by the Institute in quite a number of our other programs. And again, you have in your conference folder information on many of the Institute's activities that we've developed over the past year in response to 9/11. But I mentioned in particular Our special initiative on the Muslim world, led by former Ambassador Richard Kauslerich, which is exploring the full range of issues that will shape our dealings with Islamic states ranging from North Africa through Southeast Asia. Our rule of law program, led by Neil Kritz, which is promoting the development of legal systems in the Israeli-Palestinian context and human rights accountability and reconciliation procedures in states torn apart by violence. David Smock's Religion and Peacemaking Initiative, which is sponsoring interfaith dialogues designed to promote tolerance and understanding between Christians, Muslims, and Jews. And our training program for foreign affairs professionals, which under George Ward's leadership is working with AID and various NGOs to make reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan more effective. So what you're seeing today is an effort to contribute to this broad commitment of the Institute to in some way shift our focus, which since the mid-90s has been on developments in the Balkans in response to the events of last year, to shift our resources, our focus, our activities to the challenges raised by 9/11. So with this perspective on our purposes, it's a special honor to begin this program by introducing one of our country's most distinguished national security leaders, retired General Brent Scowcroft. Full bio information on all of our presenters is in your conference folders, but I do want to mention that many of us at the Institute have had the honor of working with General Scowcroft over the years. And the Institute, as an institution, has benefited in numerous ways from his counsel and support. So, Brent, we welcome you as our lead keynoter, and thank you very much to all of you for coming.
Thank you very much, Dick. I want to congratulate you and Chet in steering this wonderful institute into the most vital issues of the day. I'm proud to be associated with you in any respect. It's a great pleasure to kick off this conference on America's challenges in a changed world after 9/11. This is a huge topic, and as a keynoter, I will not attempt to cover everything. In fact, it reminds me of the story of a couple who was taking a vacation in Scotland, and they landed and rented a car, drove out into the countryside, and promptly got lost. And after driving around for some time, they saw this little old man sitting at an intersection whittling on a piece of wood. So they said, excuse me, sir, could you tell us the shortest way to Aberdeen? And he whittled a minute, looked up, and he said, folks, if you want the shortest way to Aberdeen, you wouldn't start from here. Anyway, I propose this morning to be something of a scene setter for the great program that you have in front of you today. To set the scene of a changed world, we must ask at least two questions. The first is, change from what? And the second is, how much is the change in the world, and how much of the change is in us? In the first decade after the Cold War, relieved from the awesome pressure of nuclear holocaust, relieved, we tended to treat foreign policy sort of like a charity, something we could engage in or not as the whim struck us. We were no longer threatened, even remotely, and we essentially drifted without any deep inquisition into what might be going on in the world. Indeed, Frank Fukuyama published a book during this period, The End of History, in which he forecast the triumph of liberal democracy, market economies, and the absence of conflict. What was going on in this period before 9/11? In particular, I want to mention two phenomena developing contrarily, but in some respects interacting. The first was globalization, primarily the fact rather than the policy of globalization, but both are involved. Borders are becoming porous. The old notion of the Treaty of Westphalia, in which national borders are an absolute barrier to the outside world on what goes on inside, that notion is crumbling under the pressure of international capital flows, communication, not only media, not only press, television, all those kinds of things, environment, and conscious developments such as Kyoto, International Criminal Court, and things like that. We're changing our world dramatically. In the United States, in Western Europe, and other developed countries, globalization was broadly seen as a good, enabling progress and prosperity in an integrating world. But the world was very different from the earlier world, say in 1945 when the United Nations was founded. It had 51 members. It now has 190. And the bulk of these new members are poor, weak, and for them, globalization is the onslaught of a bewildering melange of forces disrupting their lives, their culture, their values, and the ability of their poor governments to provide for them in the way that Westphalia assumed. And for many of these people for whom globalism is a threat, the term globalism is synonymous with the United States, because we're the ones who are carrying the flag, the McDonald's, the movies, the television. It is the onslaught of American culture which is taken to be globalism. The contrary and yet associated phenomena which is going on is the political tendency in societies to break up into ever smaller, more homogeneous, more intolerant political entities. Perhaps the connection here is groups seeking purity against the onslaught of alien forces. In any case, this has been going on during this period. And this, I believe, is a breeding ground, especially globalization, for terrorism. We didn't see it, partly because we tended to see terrorism as regional or a response to specific grievances, not existential. During this period, however, we did see the dynamism of Asia during the 1990s, and its vulnerability to globalization in the form of the extreme of capital flows in the crisis of 97-98. What we have not really noticed, however, is a growing ability of China, as it modernized, to turn out quality industrial products, coupled with the lowest wage rates almost anywhere in the world. This is a phenomenon which will dramatically change Asia and threatens the economies, even of the Asia tigers. On the other hand, of course, with WTO, the Chinese market may finally come into being. But this is a dramatic change. Our gradual estrangement with Europe continued during the 90s as the Europeans became more intent on integration, turned their gaze primarily inward, and the United States reacted by becoming contemptuous and unilateral. Russia, during the 90s, we began increasingly to ignore completely unless we wanted something from them. And then there were the holdover issues, the two Koreas, Taiwan, India, Pakistan, and the Middle East conflict, which threatened during this period as they have before and since. Into this world first came the Bush administration and then 9/11. The great change of 9/11, I believe, was in the U.S. rather than in the world, as I have described what was generally going on. For us, it was a huge discontinuity, as Dick mentioned, partly because we didn't see it coming, and partly because it was a huge departure. It was the first time in generations that Americans have felt vulnerable. It was new for us. Even in World War II, while Pearl Harbor was a horror, Hawaii was a long ways away, it wasn't a state, and for most Americans there was not the personal sense of vulnerability. That is new to us, almost uniquely in the world. In addition, the perpetrators were non-state actors, for whom the traditional notions of deterrence, retaliation, either didn't apply or took very different forms. And finally, there was the suicidal component, which, in addition to the horror of it, is very difficult to combat. The change in the United States was immediate. First, the last vestiges of what we call the Vietnam Syndrome disappeared. There was no objection, virtually no objection, to our sending forces into Afghanistan. We see the American flag everywhere now, and none of them are burning. That is a dramatic change over the previous 30 years. And our hero now is no longer the Wall Street hotshot who makes his first million long before he's 30 years old, but the policeman or the fireman who goes back in to the burning building one more time. After 9/11, there was initially a great coming together in the world. In Europe, the French of all people said, now we are all Americans. NATO invoked Article 5 for the first time. The Russians, Chinese, Pakistan, Iran, Sudan, indications of cooperation came from around the world. And this spirit helped us to get through phase one of the war on terrorism, which I think was a great military success and probably the only military phase in this war on terrorism, which is part of the problem that we face. Because we've also been engaging in military transformation. And the Afghan war showed the awesomeness of that transformation. Somehow, it doesn't work now. Because subsequent phases are unlikely to be military in the sense Afghanistan was. There are not going to be many more volunteers to be the next Taliban. And the war is going to be primarily a war of intelligence. And we're not nearly as high tech in that community with respect to this new enemy as we are in our military. This is a war, the intelligence phase. We cannot win by ourselves. We cannot do it. We have to have the cooperation of friends, allies, in capital flows, in terrorist flows. We need the help of every service because our enemy is shadowy, elusive, not playing by any of the rules that we know how to take advantage of so well. The nature of our intelligence task in this part of the war is conceptually simple, but high-tech in a new way. Whenever terrorists talk, whenever they move, whenever they spend money, whenever they get money, they leave traces. And theoretically, we ought to be able to pick up those traces. There are two problems. How do you pick them up? And then how do you separate those from the millions of other traces from people going about their daily lives? And how do you do all that while respecting the privacy of the other millions? That is a problem partly of technology, and we need to focus on it very, very deeply. I'm not going to talk about homeland security, but it is interesting that for the first time in 200 years, we now are setting up a Department of Homeland Security. We've never had one before. Why? Because early on, we were protected by two great oceans, and lately, by our power projection capabilities. And we have assumed we could keep conflict away from the United States. Now, several problems are beginning to arise in the war on terrorism. Cooperation is waning. The Europeans conceived that, in essence, we stiffed them in Afghanistan, did not accept or utilize the forces they offered until much of the conflict had been completed. We said, you know, thanks, we could do it by ourselves. And other issues, whether it's the conflict in the Middle East, the Second Intifada, whether it is Iraq, these are interfering with the concentration on the war on Al-Qaeda. Phase one is virtually over, although the mopping up will take a long time, and nation building, an essential part, will take even longer. The administration has not Explain the strategy for phase two the way it did for the Afghan phase. Last week, there was a cartoon in the Financial Times which had a billboard saying, America's Most Wanted. On the billboard was Osama bin Laden, and a workman was pasting over the front Saddam Hussein. The administration is no longer talking about globalism with a global reach. That's important in several respects. There are all kinds of terrorism. They're all repugnant, and we need to deal with them all. We cannot deal with them all at once. And by dropping the phrase which the president began with, terrorism with a global reach, and making all terrorism equal, dissipates our ability to concentrate and makes the problem, if we take it seriously, almost unmanageable. And finally, except on the East Coast, 9/11 is fading as a galvanizing concept. Can we win the war on terrorism? Yes, I think we can. In the sense that we can win the war on crime, there is going to be no peace treaty on the battleship Missouri in the war on terrorism. But we can break its back so that it is a horrible nuisance and not a paralyzing influence on our societies. To win it, however, as I said, will require close cooperation in a worldwide campaign. And it will require perseverance, patience, and focus to do it. But in the meantime, of course, the world goes on, and all of the other things which preceded 9/11 have not gone away, thus threatening to divert our attention on what is clearly the predominant problem we face. We must learn to walk and chew gum at the same time. The long-standing conflicts, the Koreas, Taiwan, Israel-Palestine, they all are as threatening as they have ever been to disrupt this world of ours. India-Pakistan came very close recently, and the notion that all terrorists are equal and a focus on preemption could play into the hands of the Indians. Incidentally, just as an aside, it is interesting to look at Kashmir and the West Bank. And in many respects, the conflicts have a great deal in common. The Indians and the Israelis are status quo. They want the violence to stop. They're quite happy with the situation the way it is. It is the Palestinians and the Pakistanis who resent the status quo and want to overturn it. And that makes for a very, very difficult conflict. There's a new element in the Middle East, and that's Al Jazeera television. You know, the Arab world has complained for over a decade about its street. You have to be careful about its street. It very well may be real now, because Al Jazeera plays night after night, day after day, pictures of Israeli tanks smashing Palestinian homes and so on. And there may really be building a fury in the region. In Europe, after the surge of 9/11, relations have resumed their decline. There's a book which will be out this fall, which discusses what it claims is a return to great power politics of the late 19th and 20th century, and that one of the fundamental conflicts is likely to be between the U.S. and Europe. I think that's probably extreme, but not impossible. And what, to me, this world demands is U.S.-European cooperation, close cooperation, and simply assuming it is not nearly enough. After a very bad first year with the Bush administration, China is beginning to be viewed with more balance. The transition of leadership seems to be going okay, and the Olympics should be a very positive influence over the next several years. There will always be rocks in the road, but that looks better than it did a year ago. Russia is a bright spot, and I think it shows the value of personal politics, because the improvement in Russian relations, I think, is heavily a result of a personal rapport between President Bush and President Putin. And in fact, it has not fully penetrated down through the bureaucracies on either side. It's not clear exactly who Putin is, but it appears we have an opportunity to attract Russia toward the West. There are a great many issues that I have not discussed. Japan, NATO, Latin America. Latin America, where the promise of the early 90s and Fukuyama's book of democracy and market economies may be in some peril. One last word on terrorism. While we can only win terrorism on the offensive, Homeland Security cannot beat the war on terrorism. We have to take the war to the terrorists. We need also to work on the predisposing factors, which Dick alluded to, behind the terrorist organizations themselves. For those countries and peoples still struggling to find their way in what for many of them is an alien world, just more economic aid will not suffice. We have to try to find new ways to reach out a hand to help these peoples and small countries into the 20th century so that the promise of technology and an integrating world can become a blessing for all rather than a curse for most. Thank you very much.